I'm Afshin Ratansi and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. As we enter the second week of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, over 2.2 million Palestinians in Gaza are plunged deeper into hunger, with hundreds of thousands on the brink of famine as the Biden administration, having pledged to build temporary docks on Gaza's shores to deliver aid, simultaneously funnels billions of dollars into arming Israel, which continues to block the flow of essential supplies like food, water and medicine to Gaza's desperate population. Joining me now is Daniel Levy, a veteran Israeli peace negotiator who participated in the official delegations for the Taba negotiations under Barak and the Oslo talks under Rabin. Levy currently serves as the president of the US Middle East Project. He joins me now from London. Thank you so much, Daniel, for coming back on. Last time we spoke, more than 1,000 Palestinians had been wounded in Jerusalem back in 2021. What has it meant, first of all, to you, witnessing what the ICJ calls plausible genocide as a former advisor to an Israeli prime minister and now at the Middle East Project there in London?
Well, I'd like to be able to say that who could have imagined, how could anyone have seen this coming? How did we get here? Unfortunately, that's not a story that anyone who is following this closely can tell themselves, because last time we spoke, we could have descended into something much worse, as you mentioned, Afshin. This was during what Palestinians have called the Unity Intifada, May 2021. There's this idea that the permanent dispossession of Palestinians, the permanent denial of their rights and freedoms, could somehow be managed in a cost-free, almost peaceful way. Of course, Palestinians, prior to October 7th, knew structural violence every day. That was their lot. But this was really blown asunder, and it was predictable. Many of us, I won't, you know, suggest that I was uniquely a person of foresight. This was painfully predictable. It's in fact the how predictable this was that is so soul-destroying, because nowhere in history across global geography can you keep a people. I'm not justifying October 7th. One violation of international law does not justify another. But of course, this was going to blow up, and it was edging ever closer. We could see it. We saw it in May 2021. We saw it with the more egregious measures that the then people were hopeful about, the Bennett Lapid government in Israel. And we saw it get ever worse with the increasing provocations of Netanyahu's coalition with Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. So I don't believe that there's such a thing as cathartic violence, but I do believe that sometimes a system that is thoroughly stuck, that feels like it's stable, but in fact is demonstrating manifest signs of instability, sometimes when there's a rupture, it creates terrible danger, it creates horrendous human suffering. That's what we've been seeing every day on our screens from Gaza. But maybe it creates an opportunity. Maybe it tells people there's no going back to the make-believe of a peace process. I'm not saying that that's what we will immediately see or that that's the narratives we're hearing right now. But I do believe that the shattering of the Israeli myth of invincibility, the shattering of the hubris and the arrogance that got us here, and of the maintainers, the enablers, the facilitators of that on the outside, could, over time, create new openings. Of course, first of all, we need to get to grips with the immediate horrendous conditions in Gaza for the Palestinian population, most of them displaced, everything flattened, at least 30,000, probably significantly more, killed off the back of what Israel went through on October 7th.
Yeah, the statistics are appalling, changing every day, of course. 13,000 Palestinian children killed, 17,000 children unaccompanied or separated, 600,000 facing displacement. I mean, the figures, if people don't know them, are watching the wrong media, arguably. You mentioned Netanyahu's coalition government. Is he convenient for the countries sending in the weapons now? Because Clearly, Netanyahu couldn't do what he wants to do, along with the other far-right members of the coalition, without the enablers of the genocide. So every time people watching this hear the name Netanyahu being spat out by Biden or Sunak or Ursula von der Leyen, is it really not... I mean, I'm not being a Netanyahu apologist. Is it not Netanyahu's fault?
Well, I think we have to give the opposite of credit where it's due. We have to lay the criminal liability at the correct door in terms of Israel's violations of international law and plausible contravening of the Genocide Convention, which is the case, as you mentioned, before the International Court of Justice brought by South Africa. So I'm not going to
exonerate,
expunge that. You know, that Netanyahu should be there in the dock. He's certainly not the only one. But I think it's correct to point out that without his enablers, this could not be carrying on. And in that panoply of people who really should get a dishonorable mention for being the enablers, the Biden administration is crucial here, because and this is something the Israelis say openly, the Israeli military would acknowledge. And this is what the lead, just to quote one, the lead correspondent in the free mass circulation Israeli daily, Israel Hayom, their correspondent said categorically, Israel could not continue this war were it not for the American military support. Now, we have seen, even in American media, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, have exposed that what we do in terms of a flow of American weaponry. But they've also pointed out that because under these conditions, certain arms transfers would need to undergo a degree of congressional scrutiny, what the administration has done is create end runs, even around the scrutiny that would have to occur within its own system in order to keep providing the artillery shells, 2,000-pound bombs, the JDAMs, the missiles, etc., most of which are not defensive, of course, most of which are the offensive weaponry, which has caused this devastation. Because if you break these arms transfers down into smaller chunks, they don't have to go through that accountability transparency cycle. So, and this, of course, is a very obvious pointer as to if anyone wanted to end this, how they could end this, you stop arming it. I do think that Netanyahu is inconvenient at this stage, even for those enablers, because it's disrupting American domestic politics for a president in a re-election year. We've seen that not just in Michigan. We're seeing that in polling across the board. It, of course, doesn't look great when you've been on your soapbox preaching a certain moral to the world, which you are now violating for an awfully long time, but with ever more voluble decibel levels in the last 2 years. So I think he's inconvenient, but clearly not inconvenient enough to stop arming.
Well, arguably Biden has done it in other countries as well. I'll get on to those arms transfers in a minute in the ICJ. But in which case, what is it that this client state, as it's been called, has on Joe Biden if it's affecting his poll numbers in Michigan with 100,000 at the primaries saying uncommitted and clearly paving the way for a Trump victory in November? What is it they have on Biden? And so you do believe that there is this, it's not just for theatrics that Biden and Netanyahu have a problem between them, which is constantly being leaked. And I should say the State Department constantly is answering questions about arms transfers and whether it violates US law to be sending arms to a country violating human rights, of course.
I think it's a legitimate question to ask, you know, is this just for show? Come on, is this not something the Americans want to see happening? And I do not want to dismiss out of hand the idea that this serves in some way American ends. But I don't think that's where we are right now in this respect. I think that the status quo ante of what has very credibly been described, not just by human rights organizations, Palestinian Israeli and International, but also by state actors in the other case at the ICJ, as the Israeli treatment of the Palestinians meeting the legal definition of a regime of apartheid. I think that is something that the Americans were totally okay with. And in fact, I think American plans for the day after Gaza are to refreeze this apartheid reality. They'll give us a load of verbiage and rhetoric about going back to a peace process and two states, but there will be nothing meaningful, consequential done in order to achieve that. So I think that's okay. I think what's going on now is problematic. I think they're taking a geopolitical hit for it. I think their attempts to create an updated version of a Pax Americana for the Middle East has been dealt a setback by this action.
Well, it's worse than that, I'm telling you from here. But just very quickly, though, why doesn't he just call Netanyahu and say, let the aid through, instead of this... it's been seen as, even in the United States, even from so-called mainstream media, I mean, this idea of... some people saying it's the gas reserves off the coast of Gaza. What is all these piers and ports and US soldiers, when he can just phone Netanyahu and say, let the trucks come in through northern Gaza and the job is done? Why doesn't he? What has Netanyahu got on Biden?
First of all, I want to not make it easy on us. I don't think he can pick up the phone and say, let the trucks through and it's done. I think he has the leverage to achieve not only that outcome, but the ultimately more urgent or equally urgent outcome of getting a ceasefire, because you get the trucks in. If the Israeli military actions are still continuing, then you're never going to be able to play catch up with the devastation that is being caused by what you get in through humanitarian.
And they vetoed. And they vetoed, of course. And Britain abstained.
And then they veto at the, of course, alongside the arms transfers, there's the vetoes at the UN Security Council. There is the responses to the ICJ, where the US has called the South African case meritless when 16 judges ruled for provisional measures, including the American judge who at the time was in the chair. And, you know, as you know, and it's important for us to note, that the airdrops and this idea of a seaport pier are really a demonstration of American weakness. It's pathetic, because what needs to get in is the aid, the volume of which you can get in right now through those land borders on trucks that Israel is preventing. Now, why, therefore, is that not being pushed, given the leverage that the US has? And to understand that, I don't think we can do justice to that without American domestic politics and the role that Israel has played in American domestic politics.
It's just the lobby.
Well, it's the lobby, but it's the Israel lobby in all its manifestations that goes beyond the Israel lobby. So it's absolutely the Jewish pro-Israel groups. It's the evangelical pro-Israel groups who don't have a hold on the Democrat Party, but they mean that the Republican Party is absolutely in lockstep with the most hawkish elements inside Israel. I think the arms industry isn't particularly keen to see a ceasefire, but...
Well, hang on. Daniel Levy, I'll stop you. Yeah. I'll just stop you there. More from the former Israeli peace negotiator under Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Daniel Levy, former Israeli peace negotiator under Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin, and now president of the US Middle East Peace Project. Daniel, before I rudely interrupted at the end of part one, you were talking about why it is that American politics is so skewed about the genocide in Gaza.
So, far be it from me to tell the leadership, the Democratic establishment, the White House, how to manage their domestic politics. But I do think one could make an argument that this is a misreading of their own domestic politics, that in fact, with a Democrat supporting constituency, support doing this is doing more harm than good. However, that is the president's read of his domestic politics. It certainly fits with what we know about the role of campaign finance in the US.
He gets more money than any other, doesn't he, from Israeli lobbyists?
Well, I don't even know if that's true, because there's a lot of attempts...
That's what the Grey Zone said. The Grey Zone...
Well, I would actually question that. The idea that this in any way benefits Biden's re-election, we will know in November to some degree. One can't isolate any given factor, but I think it's a misreading of contemporary American politics. I think we should at least consider that Biden, the person Biden, that it's gotten this bad, is that the person Biden apparently speaks to Golda Meir in his sleep. And I say that semi-jokingly, because whenever he talks about Israel, he still refers to a prime minister from more than half a century ago. Okay, so, you know, this is a
that
bit
could be his
Biden
mental illness, as special counsel talked about.
So it's a bit specific to Biden, but I also would acknowledge that it's not just about that. America has a geopolitical management framing for the Middle East region. It involves certain, you've called Israel a client state, I'm not sure I'd use the word client, but it involves certain states in the Arab state system that are very close to the US. It involves Israel as a central node. And if Israel's acting up a bit, maybe stepping beyond the lines that the US would rather it confined itself to, that is still not going to interrupt the fundamental geopolitics. It's much easier if an administration can tell us a global geopolitical story of good guys and bad guys, and what Israel and others have done to disrupt that is really quite significant. And finally, we should not tell ourselves this story that this is so out of sync with American values. I mean, one settler colonial society to another. There may be a gap here of 100 or more years. But going back to this point about picking up the phone, because this is also part of the story. For the Netanyahu government to let what's needed in by way of humanitarian assistance and to end the kinds of actions it is taking in Gaza, I think would require a sustained standoff. In other words, it's not just that first phone call. It's after week one, after week two, you're not providing the weapons. You're not vetoing stuff at the UN Security Council. You would need to be able to sustain this. I think they know that. I think they do not read their own politics as allowing them to do that, because Netanyahu will push back. It will take time. I believe that the Israeli system, the military, the public will not sustain the non-provision, especially of American weapons, and the military especially will say, listen, guy, we don't care what story you tell yourself, you tell the public, but you're going to have to move in the direction they're telling you to. So yes, America has the leverage. No, it's not one phone call. Yes, they have their own reasons for not using that leverage.
And I suppose it should be said that while Netanyahu may not be popular within Israel more generally, he is popular as per the engagement of this genocide. People in Israel, a majority, do seem to support the genocide, which means that given what you just said and given what I just said, is this paving the way for expansion into a regional war? I don't know what you think of the British and American airstrikes on Yemen for showing solidarity with the Palestinians in their enforcing of an embargo. I mean, the word Iran keeps being mentioned in the United States as part of political rhetoric all the time, as it does in Europe increasingly.
Let me quote you what the Swedish former Prime Minister, Foreign Minister Carl Bildt, he said, maybe we should take seriously the idea that if we want to end what's going on in the Red Sea and resume shipping lanes in an uninterfered way, rather than bombing Yemen, end the war in Gaza. So this is someone from the heart of that establishment acknowledging a reality which is just staring us in the face. The Houthis have been very open about why they're doing this. And I think sometimes one should take people at face value. So yes, the idea that you can distinguish between these two things, just get the ceasefire in Gaza if you want to at least calm to some degree the region. This is not going well for the West. It's not going well on the battlefield for Israel. the balance of forces. Israel, of course, has the firepower to kill Gaza and civilians, but this is not a display of strength when you're doing this. It's a display of weakness when you won't send your infantry in, so you just bomb and bomb and bomb. Regionally, Iran is not deployed directly. Hezbollah has only played a role up to a certain level, tying down some Israeli forces in the north. So without those two major actors, you still have a catastrophic Israeli own goal in terms of the political, legal, moral, reputational jeopardy that it is engaged in. And you have this successful Houthi intervention to disrupt global trade. So it's not going well. Maybe even in its own interest terms, the West should be looking at this again.
And this in a week when there were joint Iranian, Chinese and Russian Navy patrols down the road here in the Gulf of Oman, the Ukraine proxy war not going to plan as the Global South wants negotiations, which have been outlawed by Zelensky, of course, backed by the EU and the US, which means, and I know you've made a case for it, that China should have a central role, perhaps, in some kind of peace negotiation. I know Palestinian negotiators were in Moscow only the other day. Is it time now, away from the accords that you are involved in, for China and Russia to step up to the plate? Because despite their calling for a ceasefire at the UN Security Council, and despite many on the Arab street, so-called, wanting China and Russia perhaps to come in like people on white horses to save the starving and the survivors of the genocide, they're not going to. But how can Moscow and Beijing help?
You're right. Let's line up some of those ducks, as you've just kind of helped us do, Afshin. So first of all, the Netanyahu is not popular. The military operation is popular. And I just think this speaks to the fact that the Israeli public have gotten used to impunity. And that's the ultimate culpability of Israel's allies in getting us to this moment, because by never holding Israel accountable, you have been the handmaiden to extremism, and you normalize everything that Israel has done. You normalize that apartheid, you normalize Ben-Gvir and Smotrich being in the government. So that's number one. Number two, there's a whole piece of this, which I very much doubt we'll go into, but you mentioned in passing the intra-Palestinian talks that the Russians have been hosting. There is a whole piece of this, which is about the Palestinian body politic having basically collapsed. Israel, of course, sowed that division. That's a classic divide and rule thing one would expect, but the Palestinian factions have not managed to rise above that. And of course, the authority recognized internationally has essentially become an adjunct of the Israeli occupation and of the West's involvement in that. So bringing this back then to what does it mean for the US monopoly on peace efforts? And those peace efforts are a sham. That is the story of so-called peacemaking in the last decade, two decades, perhaps. I think anyone who's serious about wanting to get this to a place where the events of October 6th, when things were terrible for Palestinians, October 7th, when things were terrible for Israelis, and every day since, anyone who wants to get beyond that needs to look at a different architecture, a different way of doing that. I think that has to break the US and Western monopoly. When the Madrid talks were first launched, you had the US and a then weakened Russian Federation coming out of the former Soviet Union as the co-hosts. I think it would be sensible to think about a Chinese role. I think it would be sensible to think about a role of the Global South, which isn't a thing, but some of the mid-level powers that are part of that, whether that's Indonesia, South Africa, Brazil, those who Israel won't be happy to see at the table. But the Palestinians should not be happy to see the Americans at the table. So I think you have to break that monopoly. There is a role to play. I think when it comes to Russia and China, if they want to play more actively in this, they're going to have to look beyond their own limitations and the fact that they themselves continue to use this rhetoric of let's have an international conference, let's have two states. They're going to have to get beyond that because that does not accord with the reality today. And finally, There is the region itself. There is the fact that there is an Arab hinterland to Israel's occupation of the Palestinians, which has been unable to muster to generate a serious challenge, unable, unwilling, too restricted by its own geopolitics, by the nature of its own governance structures, unwilling, unable to generate a real challenge. Those countries that made those normalization deals with Israel in the Abraham Accords have been an enabler as well. They've played that role.
Albeit, so they would say, the Arab League was a co-petitioner. Just finally, obviously it was South Africa. It moved a lot of anti-apartheid activists that it would be South Africa bringing the ICJ petition. But is the ICJ also on trial here, the so-called World Court? It could have ordered a cease and desist order immediately, which would have prevented arms trading from Western European countries. Time for a look at this World Court while we witness this genocide on a day-by-day, hour-by-hour basis.
I don't think so, because I think what the provisional measures ordered by the court amounted to was the things that should then have been...
Well, it was open to interpretation, which isn't good enough. They could have put their foot down.
Well, even if they put their foot down, it then has to be implemented, right? It's not none of this. The point here, Avshin, I think, is none of this is self-implementing. A Security Council resolution isn't self-implementing. An ICJ ruling, as we know from other instances, none of this is self-implementing. They do not have the power to implement. It then depends on other actors, whether they're going to ignore what the court has said. Of course, they can't ignore what the court could have said, but they've ignored what the court has said. Israel had 30 days to report. Israel provided a report that has not been made public. The South Africans have now gone back with a request for further provisional measures. But whatever the court rules, it is up to those who claim they want to be in good standing with international legality to either abide by those rulings or, as you suggest, to further take an axe to the institutional international structures of global governance and the ability just to do anything by ignoring those rulings. And I think what the events and the response to those events of the last months have shown us is that we do not have anything even approaching an international order fit for purpose. And that's a really dangerous place to be. And I think whether it's Israel in its moment right now or that global architecture, this is a dangerous time. You've referred to other conflicts going on, and I agree with you. And I think the global South is looking at this and say, and it's interesting, the Americans in the West aren't even trying anymore to pass resolutions to win people over for their claims elsewhere in the world because they have no standing whatsoever.
Daniel Levy, thank you.
Thank you, Avshin.
And that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by UK-US-EU armed bombing in Palestine, Lebanon, Yemen, Syria and Iraq. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.